Wordplay TJ is a musical artist. Really, really, really enjoy his music. I got turned on to him by a friend. He makes great, great rap music. He's also a producer. He makes music for the underdog. He explains why in our conversation here. But fascinating young man. And we talk about his process of creating his music and how he produces and how he has other artists that he works with. He's an excellent marketer as well. I want to talk about three particular songs in this conversation that I really liked and had questions about. Really great discussion with Wordplay TJ. Really enjoy him. I enjoy talking to artists just like him, just the way that they think and the way they can get their art and put it in a form like that for all of us to consume. It's just wonderful. I can't say enough great things. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I know you will. You'll enjoy this conversation. He's a fascinating young man. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Joey Pins. People ask me, how did I lose 130 pounds? The quick answer is always discipline. I started my business, wasn't paying attention to my health, was eating too much, drinking too much sweets. My daughter was born. Next thing I know, I'm pre-diabetic, I have hypertension. I knew something had to change. Discipline. I, like many of you, have faced many challenges in your career, in your family, in your life, in your faith. How did you attack them? How did you approach them? How did you solve them, hopefully? It all had to have some degree of discipline. I'm also asked, how did you found and start a tech business that lasted over 25 years? Discipline. I was committed to it, enjoyed technology, didn't enjoy some aspects of it, but knew it was necessary. Discipline. Our podcast mission, how do we use discipline to better ourselves and society? Join me, please, as I talk to interesting people and discuss how they use discipline in their family, in their passion, in their careers, and how it helped them. Our podcast vision, growth through learning from others. Joey Pins Discipline Conversations. It'll be light and serious. Join us, please. Thank you for consideration. So many questions. Thanks for your time today. I'm a big fan of your music, and I want to get into some of the songs right away. But tell me, what's the difference between a good song and a great song?
I think a good song is one that is maybe put together in a very, kind of systematic way. There's the elements of good song attached to it. But it's very scientific. It's very kind of robotic in nature and formulaic. Mm. But a great song has elements of the emotionality and captures the moment and takes a lot of the things that they're intangible things that we can't really quantify. Those are in great songs.
So then I think you're talking about the difference between art and science. So how much? Right. So what's the percentage of can a great song be all science? Can it be all system?
I think a great song has balance, and it's a balance of emotionality. It's a balance of the art and the science, because when folks work with record labels, for example, the record labels will push for a lot of the science. They'll say, this has worked. We need to repeat this. And they take a very scientific approach to creating records. And artists, on the other side, take a very artistic approach to creating music. And I think a good shuffle between the two, a good balance between the two is best.
Yeah, you hear that time and time again. You see these bands come out and you could just tell somebody saying, hey, try to sound like them or try to be like them. How much of your music specifically is completed in the studio and versus out of the studio? How much do you actually like re-engineer? Do you rethink? Do you add more art once you're in the studio and you're actually producing it?
Yeah. So my process is not that complicated, but at at the same time, there's a lot of steps involved. So when I start a song, usually the music comes first. I'm feeling out the sounds and the textures and things of that nature, and I add a lot at first, and then I start subtracting from what that music is and the musicality of it. And then once I finalize the sequence of an instrumental, I start to think about the words. And sometimes I take a day to kind of step away from it and then come back and then step away. So my writing process could either be 15 minutes or 15 days. It just really depends. And I let the music kind of speak to me. That's the art piece, right? And then the scientific piece is me going in and recording. And that's when I'm in the studio. So everything before that was outside of the studio. Everything after that is inside the studio. But in the recording process, I also allow my my gut feelings to come into play. So if I want to sing something or perform something or rap something in the moment, I'll do it. And oftentimes, even if I have a imperfect take, I'll keep that take because it felt the best. And so that's kind of where I have it kind of, you know, outside the studio and inside the studio. Most of the end process, recording, engineering, all of that stuff is mostly emotion when I'm putting it together. And then when I'm engineering, that's when the science comes in. That's when, you know, the levels and the frequencies and understanding a good balance of everything comes into play.
Wow. And is it always the case that the music is first?
For me now it is. Before, I used to write the words first. So back when I started making music, and I've been making music since 2005.
And eight albums.
Yeah. In 2005, like, I was writing all of the songs. Like, I would come up with lyrics. And this, I was in high school at the time. So like, I would come home, create lyrics while I'm at school, and then put them to some music. And I started to realize that that process felt really backwards for me. It felt very challenging for me to come up with the exact sounds I need to match the lyrics. And so I started to make those adjustments to doing the music first, and then that will inform all the words.
Wow. And that spark. So I'm thinking specifically, one of my favorite of your songs is someone Else's Dreams. And so I get to kind of interpret it as, well, let me just ask you, what's the responsibility of a business owner to make the employees feel like they're part of the winning process, as if they're part of the organization and not just a stooge or somebody who doesn't matter?
Yeah. So Someone Else's Dream is kind of controversial in a way, and it's from my album Orientation Day. And when I made that song, it has a long journey, but and so I may kind of like get away from your question a little bit, because this particular topic is really exciting for me. But when I think about bosses first, let me focus on the question. When I think about bosses and the employee dynamic, I believe it's the employer's job to make the employee's life as comfortable as possible in order for them to perform at their highest level every time they come into that business. And it's not realistic to say that everybody is going to pursue their own dream. And I understand that now, right? On the grand probabilities of things, most people will work for somebody, but they do have their own dreams and they do have their own perspectives when they come into that building. And you, as an employer, have to understand what their dreams are and see where they best fit within your equation.
My goodness. Yeah. Well said. Yeah. It's just the, when I first heard it, you know, I started a business in the 90s and I'm like, my goodness, have I done that? Have I been guilty of that? I wonder. And I've worked for many others. In the case of that particular song, did the lyrics come first?
The music came first. So really? That is, so on, I'm sorry, on Job Application, that's the album it's from, sorry. On Job Application, I started with the sounds first. And that was a transformation for me. That was a moment where I was just like, okay, this music needs to be the thing that leads the way. And so when I made this, you know, kind of cloudy, you know, just kind of like airy instrumental and in the background, it has this, you know, kind of rhythmic thing going on. I was like,
it's beautiful.
Oh, somebody else's dream is what it's saying to me. You know, I'm waking up early morning and I'm yawning. I don't want to, but I'm waking up to, you know, to someone else's dream. And that's the story of a lot of people's lives. And I wanted to encapsulate that story. So in Job Application, the album is me kind of talking with my parents about the reality of the jobs that we have to be in. And is there something wrong with me having this perspective of, I don't necessarily want to work that job. I want to kind of work for myself. And where do I strike that balance? And so it's kind of a coming to a realization in that entire project.
Yeah, well, that'll lead me into the next song at the top. But before we get there, mm-hmm. you know, you gave me chills when you said that you created this music and then something came up to you and said, it's dreamy. And it's so, forgive me, but I can't, what do you do with the blank page? How do you come up with music like that? Do you hum it in your head? How does that transition to actual music being played?
Yeah, so that process is transformed over time as well. In the beginning, I was like humming melodies and thinking of chord progressions and things of that nature that I could work on. But as time went on, I started sampling first, and sampling became something that was important to me. I have a mentor, Amir Saeed, from New York City, and he wrote a book on sampling. And once I started to kind of study that discipline, it informed my entire process. And so the Someone Else's Dream, the sounds that come from that are elements from a database. It's a database of kind of sounds and things of that nature. And so I found a kind of cloudy instrument, and I started playing it on my keyboard that's kind of under my desk. And I was transitioning from notes and notes. And then I found the perfect like sequence. And I was like, this is it. So it's those moments where you get that feeling of this is it, that it's kind of time to put that in action, put that puzzle piece into the entire puzzle.
Wow. And have you ever been sleeping or doing something else and a tune or a melody comes into your head or a lyric comes in and you know that it's something very good and you're anticipating you bring it to paper or bring it to the studio or bringing it together? Does that like moment of inspiration happen often? And what is that like?
So when I'm creating, the inspiration behind everything is spontaneous. So I could sit at my keyboard and I sit down with the intention to like make something. And that's a like you talk about discipline a lot, right? That's one of my disciplines. It is me sitting down and saying, hey, today I'm gonna make something. And I'm not going to inform the process. I'm not because when I try to force it, that's when nothing comes. But I sit down, I'm at the piano, I'm at my drum machine, and I start tinkering. And as long as you get in the habit of like starting it, it's one of those things where something will come of it eventually. And so for my process, as I'm like keying around, again, yeah, I hear something, it's immediate, I understand what it is, and I start adding on top of it. And sometimes I will have like five iterations of instrumentals before I get to that one, or maybe even 10 within a session. And so sometimes I can go back into my catalog of beats and I can say, well, I never did anything with this, but it sounds kind of good. Let me move into it. Let me work with it a little bit more. And that's what I did with my newest album that's coming up. So me and some friends met in a garage here locally, and I started pulling up old files, you know, from these moments where I'm like creating. And I was like, hey, this actually sounds kind of good. Can we play something on top of it? So my friend Kevin and Thomas and Matt, they all played on top of those instrumentals or those kind of foundations for instrumentals. And we started to kind of build on top of it in a very organic way.
That's incredible. And have you ever written something and then found out that you just don't feel it's in your voice and it should be done by somebody else?
It happens a lot.
Really?
So my company, Onomat Music Group, we have a few other artists involved. And sometimes when I'm making something, I hear it for them. Sometimes when I'm making something, I was just like, I like how it sounds, but I don't hear me in it. And then sometimes like months will go by and I'll listen to it again, and then something comes immediately. And so when I say like I'm not informing the process, I feel like I'm a Christian, so I feel like God is informing that process. I also believe that spiritually we're always connected to the universe, and so the universe is like an organization of a lot of chaotic things, and these ideas are already floating out there. And so every once in a while I'll be in the process and I'll capture one of these ideas. And so that's the I feel like the thesis of all of my artistic work.
So there's this old story, who knows if it's true, Bob Dylan created all Along the Watchtower. Within days, Jimi Hendrix performs it. And Bob Dylan hears Jimi Hendrix performs it and says, that song should have never been mine. And he never played it again. That's Jimi Hendrix's song. This is the same principle you're talking about here.
Yeah. The same phenomena comes with like Dolly Parton. I Will Always Love You, right? That's like right. She wrote that song, and that's, you know, that's her song. And then Whitney Houston comes and performs it, and everybody thinks it's Whitney's song, right? So it's one of those things where even though two artists can resonate with the same music, ultimately it may not be theirs. And that's a philosophy I take with putting out art in general, right? Once it's out there, it's not mine anymore. Right. It was mine to deliver to everybody, but it's not mine anymore.
It's very, very important concept that people need to understand. I know, like when I go into, you know, I'm here in the Northeast. I go to MoMA in New York City, and I walk out of there with a headache almost, because to me, it's like 50, it's like 100 concerts going on at the same time, because each painting is just so different. I just kind of want to stay with one for a while and maybe two or three and then leave. You know, it's just so much art there, and we get to interpret it, like you said, the way we want to. And that's a really important concept, because oftentimes people get stuck on, well, what did the artist intend on this? Did they? And they've come up with some nefarious or, you know, outlandish, you know, and it's not, I don't believe that, just like you, I believe exactly what you said. It's us to us to interpret. You say you make music for the underdog. Please explain. Mm-hmm.
So music for the underdog is a very simple concept. I believe that a lot of us out here have some challenges, some trials, some things that we need to go over. And that's who I make music for. I want to make music for people that are trying to, like, if they don't have their discipline just right, like they have something to kind of make them stick it and stick that, you know, stick that landing at some point. And so music for the underdog, it is making sure that all of the sounds, all of the art that I do, all of the advice videos that I do on YouTube, all of those things are prepared for people that are trying to make it to the next level. So it's like a, it's like a high school to graduation sort of phase where you're unsure of yourself. You're just, you're still trying to figure it out. You may lose a lot, right? I think that's a part of the process, right? So making sure that we understand that losses aren't truly losses. They're opportunities to learn. That's my whole thing when I come to like making music for the underdog is understanding. When we think about underdogs, we think about people that lose a lot, in my opinion. And so those underdogs at like football games and things of that nature, those teams that have historically like just kind of lost, but they still have their fan base, that those are the folks that I'm speaking to oftentimes. And so I want to let people know that those losses aren't really losses. They're learning opportunities. They're opportunities to hone in your discipline and to get better. And so if you're stuck in that place, listen to what I've gone through and maybe you can come out of it.
I guess that leads us into my other song, great song I wanted to talk about, is At the Top. And, you know, just making that, you know, evolution, I guess you could say, the top. And, you know, I'm a little bit older than you. I believe I'm 53 and you're a young man. And so the quote that I thought of after listening to this song was, the wolf at the bottom of the hill is always hungrier than the wolf on the top of the hill.
Yeah. So I can say, I think it kind of correlates, because when I think about that song, I think the wolf is climbing that hill. And so therefore they are at a kind of lower elevation. And I think that climb is very lonely. Like the desire to get there is one that maybe your friends may not appreciate, your family may not appreciate, your coworkers won't understand, even potential customers and fans, they don't understand what that climb really means, what you need to sacrifice, what kind of discipline you need to have in order to get there, and how much resilience you need to learn from those losses. And so I take At the Top to be a story of that journey, right? You know, I'm gonna put in work until I'm dead. Like that is my motto. And Will Smith, in a, you know, pretty popular interview of his, is saying like, I'd be on the treadmill and I'm gonna go, and if somebody's on a treadmill next to me, I'm going to die on that treadmill, right? That's kind of where that line came from. And I was just like, yeah, I'm gonna make sure that I'm in it for life, right? And this is my philosophy. So even, you know, at retirement age, I still want to be that hungry.
Hard to do. Yeah. What do you want we don't like to use the word fans, the listeners that appreciate your music. What should they know about you?
So I think if you're talking about your listeners or even my listeners, I think that I believe I want them to know that I put them first, right? I think about them more than I think about myself. It's very important for me to make a real connection with individuals. And it's also important for me to have one-to-one relationships with those that listen to me. And so what makes it difficult is this sort of this dynamic that we have maybe in this country as a culture where fans are removed from the people that they appreciate. And we're starting to kind of close those gaps with social media. But it's really, really important for me to know that, like, as a fan, you can reach out to me. And as a creator, I can reach out to you and we can go back and forth and trade experiences. Some of my biggest supporters are my closest friends.
Have you always been an artist?
Yeah. I'm a visual artist. First, I started drawing and painting at 6 years old. And then I transitioned into music in middle school. And I've always just kind of balanced the two in my work. And so my upcoming album, my new album, you're the first to hear the title. It's going to be called Terry. And in the album Terry, I'm balancing those two dynamics. I want to have a art exhibit where I show off my portfolio of artwork that I've built over, you know, my lifetime. But I also want to encapsulate who I am in this album. And that's why it's self-titled. And so I want to have like a little exhibit in a public space to showcase both of those things. So I've always been an artist. I've always been making pictures and videos and artwork and drawings, but I've also been making music as well. And that has taken me to a whole nother place, right? That's why it's, I feel like it's more than just music for the underdog at this point. It's kind of everything for the underdog, because it's all about encapsulating this brand that is me, that's Wordplay TJ.
Next song I want to talk about is Obsessed. I love it. I mean, is it common for artists to have self-doubt?
Yes. Yes. Obsessed, another record from my most recent album, Overtime. It is very consistent with the artistic sort of, I would say, It's hard to know exactly what to call it. It's maybe like a strife or just like a kind of thing on every artist's back to be obsessed with like the process and who's gonna listen to this, who's gonna like this, am I gonna be liked, am I gonna be accepted, and knowing that from all artists that we all go through that same thing. It helps me translate that into a song. And there's also obsession over sort of people in life, and right, where you can be so into what other people need that you start to kind of lose yourself in that obsession. And that's the dynamic of artists to listener or supporter, or even artists to their friends and family. Like, we're always consumed with, am I doing the best for all these other folks? And so obsession bookends with, I may need to focus on myself a little bit and be obsessed with me.
Wow. Well said. Because yeah, it's very, it's self-revealing. It's very open. And then, you know, forget about the, you know, it's also very just hypnotic and melodious and the lyrics just pull you in and
thank you.
Really, really enjoy it. So the difference between rap and hip hop is the culture. Is that a good definition?
Yeah, hip hop is definitely the culture. Rap is a byproduct of said culture, right? Rap is a product of street life, in my opinion. And so when making hip hop, you have to think about all of those elements, dance, the art, the emceeing, and the DJ. Those are the four elements of hip hop. And those are encapsulated throughout the culture, and they evolve over time. Rap music, I feel like it was an advent of something of the 1980s, where, you know, street life and drugs and things of that nature started to infiltrate the Black community as a whole. And so you get byproducts
HIV.
That you get byproducts that are sort of dualities, right? So you get hip hop on one side, where you have Public Enemy, like, speaking to those you know, kind of ills, but NWA is also speaking to those ills as well. They're just doing it from a perspective of the streets, and that's rap.
I was first introduced to, you know, so I'm in New Haven. I have a lot of friends in the Bronx and in Queens, but I was first introduced by friends here. So it was Run DMC was my first, and LL Cool J and Public Enemy certainly came along. And you know, in 1985, when Rock the Bells was just played everywhere in the Bronx and everywhere you turn, and you know, I'm rhyming and designing with your girl on my lap. I mean, what is this is blowing us away. He can't say that, you know. And we just went crazy. And then, you know, the first Public Enemy album was a bit ambiguous, but second, you know, he got a little bit more involved in, you know, messaging. And I say of course Chuck D got more involved in messaging. And and then the third was fantastic as well. But what is the state of rap now? Is it in a good place?
It's in a place where it's maturing, right? Because the genre itself, hip hop in general, is like over 40 years old now. It's in a space where I feel like in rock music or even pop music, right? There's a lot of people that are allowed to get old in their cultures. Hip hop and rap, like, so this culture, that subculture, sometimes we don't allow people to mature. And because oftentimes success is tied to how young you are. And now I feel like hip hop is in a space where it's allowed to mature, just like rock, just like other genres of music. And so now we have a duality, right, where the youngsters are saying, I don't know if I want to go in the studio and follow your cadences that are very robotic. I don't know if I want to go into the studio and enunciate words. I don't know if I want to go into the studio and even follow a rhyme structure. I just want to hum and give you some melodies. Like, that's where the youngest folks of the hip hop generation are. And the older folks are still within that, like, kind of rhyme structure and those four elements of hip hop. They're also in a space where they want to really still be here and have a fan base. And so Nas just won a Grammy, right? Is a great example of that. And he just put out the follow-up to that album that won him the Grammy, and it sounds phenomenal. It's a great, great blend of what's important today to individuals, like the melodies and the beats and the instrumentals, plus the lyrics, which we know that he's a master of.
Incredible. What do record companies, streaming companies, the Grammys you just mentioned, what do they have to do better to help artists?
I think they need to get out of the way.
I've watched them. Yeah.
They got to get out of the way. And the only way that they do that is by building out new deal structures. They have to realize that they're not necessarily the owners of the product. And this is where that kind of conversation about the art versus the kind of science comes into play. They agree with the laws, right, of copyright and all these other things. And artists, in most cases, do not think much about copyright when they're making art. And so the record labels are, they're about commerce. They're about profit margin. They're about ownership. And that's what I teach on my music advice channel on YouTube, is making sure that artists prioritize ownership, but also record labels have some accountability to give or allow people to have some ownership. I understand that it's a trade-off, right? There's an investment. There's a return on investment that they want. And that's science, right? That's the business. That's the science of business. But I think that they should be more calculated in the risk that they take. For me, they take a very shotgun approach to a lot of this, and they're getting better at it with social media, right, and those types of things, but it's still very shotgun. They take everything that goes viral and then they just put it out, and so they give money to people that go viral, and they're just flashing the pan. So they might recoup on a single deal, but there's no longevity with that. There's longevity in the art. And so people have to structure new deals to work with people on a regular basis. And that's what I do with On a Map Music Group, is my artists, they own their catalog, and they can take their catalog if they want to. We split revenue 80-20, 20% my way, 80% their way.
Wow.
They're publishing, it's theirs. And I teach them how to get it. Their ownership is theirs. And I teach them how to control it. And that's what I feel like a new record label is about.
Incredible. You know, you talked about, the copywriting and all the business at these record companies. One of my favorite albums of all time, De La Soul, 3 Feet High and Rising, that will never be put out on Spotify because all the samples, they didn't pay, or they have to pay. And I had the CD at one point, but I got rid of all my CD, you gave in some of your YouTube videos, you said 80-20, which is incredible, but you gave some incredible percentages, 70% from iTunes.
Yeah.
Goes. Performance shows are generally around 60%.
Mm-hmm. So some of the percentages that kind of come to artists, and when we're talking about the business of making records and performing those records, there are a lot of different buckets where artists can draw revenue from. You know, the idea of like the seven streams of income. Well, every artist has at least seven streams that they can draw from the time that they make a song. And so the iTunes part is just one of those streams. Streaming in and of itself is a second bucket. Publishing is another bucket. Owning the copyright and master recording is another bucket. And so those and live performances is a fifth bucket. And I could go on for days about the type of buckets that artists can draw from. And so, yes, whenever somebody sells a record on iTunes will take 30%. And then they'll send it to your distributor. The distributor will take their percentage if they take a percentage. CD Baby is different from DistroKid, where DistroKid will, you know, give you 100%. CD Baby may take 15% off of it. So you have your distributor, you have iTunes, then your distributor, then you, if you're independent. If you're not independent, you have the record label in between you, and then you.
Wow. And I notice on Spotify, there's a way you can kind of give money directly, and that Spotify doesn't get a piece.
Spotify doesn't get a piece of that. Yeah, that's a brand new thing that came about where you can, where people can link their profile to Cash App and people can donate to them.
And how is Spotify as far as iTunes? I mean, when just streaming itself. I mean, I don't know how many times I've listened to your songs, 50, 100, 150. I mean, do you see much revenue from that?
So that's the thing, is that streaming is on a different equation than an actual download. So a download would take 99 cents, but that's not the equivalent to a stream. And so a stream in most cases is about, on average, 0.003 cents. And so
that's 2 zeros.
Yeah, 2 zeros, 0.003 per stream. And that's, you know, 0.003 of a penny per stream. That's the dollar amount in most cases. So knowing that, you have to have way more streams to equal out to enough revenue to make it. It's almost a million streams that you have to make a kind of living wage.
Wow. And you mentioned the best thing, if people like it, they're more apt to listen to it more and put it in their playlist and things like that. How can we better support our artists?
So I just did a video about this where I talk about how fans can support artists that they like. Number one is share it, right? Mm-hmm. If you like something, share it. There's a tendency for music fans to share it only in like really private and intimate settings. But music fans don't often share their music publicly, because they're like afraid of the shame that might come from somebody not liking it.
That's interesting.
And so if you like something, just say it out loud, right? One, as a fan. And secondly, right, try to find other ways to support that artist. If that artist has a Bandcamp page and you stream their music a lot, maybe download their album and pay them $10, because you don't have to do anything with that album or that file. It's just saying, hey, I like you, I support you, and I want you to keep doing this. So here's $10 for this album, even though I don't have a utilitarian use for it. Buy some merch, right? Merchandise is a big deal. And that's another way that you can share it with other people without having to like put yourself out there and be vulnerable, right? So sharing a song is a vulnerability point, but wearing a Wordplay TJ logo or a Orientation Day hat is a billboard. And somebody might come up to you and say, what's Orientation Day? And it's like, oh, I listened to this guy called Wordplay TJ. He has a couple songs that I like, and like, oh yeah, it's really, really good. And then, you know, type it into Google. And that's another thing that I teach artists is, right, be Googleable. And type it into Google in their phone and then just say, this is how you can find them. And as long as that discoverability is there, your fans will propel you to the next level.
Absolutely. I love one thing that you said a while ago, and I wrote it down. I forget to mention it again, but you said that, kind of paraphrasing, that the record companies will kind of come and go, but the artists will always be there.
Right. Right. So we know from the advent of the internet that a lot of record companies failed and they folded. And now we're in a situation where we have the big four. I think it's like Sony, Universal. It may not be BMG. I think it's Atlantic and some other ones that are, you know, just the major primary record label, and every other big entity is within them. But now we have independent labels that are starting to pop up. And those independent labels are starting to build their longevity, right? So like TDE with Kendrick Lamar and that crew. The Empire, where it's an independent label that provides artist supports, and then they have a revenue share together. And so they work really hard to blow their artist up, even if they're obscure in the beginning.
The rapper from Chicago who had created his own label and won all those Grammys.
Chance the Rapper?
Chance. Yeah. Now he's independent, correct?
He is independent. And from what I know, he has been completely independent from day one. The thing about Chance is that he had a really good manager in his corner, and his manager did a lot of legwork. So he built a team and had some partnerships early on that helped propel him to the next level. And even now, he still has a great team around him, and he's still independent. And he's searching for a lot of those connections. But him and his manager are not together anymore. His first manager. And so I say all that to say that, like, one of the stories that I borrowed from Chance, or one of the lessons that I borrowed from Chance, is he says that iTunes, say you call up iTunes and you want to promote your album and you know you have a date coming up. He said iTunes can tell a bigger artist no. Cardi B, iTunes can say no to Cardi B just like they can say no to me. So if you're independent, call up anyway. Put out that request, because you never know when they'll say yes. So what independent artists don't do is they don't try to make those big connections because they think they're bigger than themselves. And the reality is that they're very accessible. I talk to people at Pandora all the time. And I have relationships with people at TuneCore. And I have relationships with people that, like, do jukeboxes around the country and have my music in them. And so I just send emails and say, hey, can this happen? Or if I need to get on the phone, I'll make a phone call and build those relationships. And that's crucial to being independent.
Now, I remember a couple years ago, there was an issue with iTunes where if they were on trial, they didn't have to pay the artist. And then Taylor Swift got involved and she said, if you don't change this, I'm backing out. And they changed it in a day. But obviously she's a major star. She had a lot of power there.
Yeah. That's just a situation where, like, a company's trying to save money. And if people aren't paying them, they don't have a source of revenue. They don't want to shell out more money, but they easily reversed it because they know they can afford it. But they can't afford to lose Taylor.
Poor Apple's only a $1 trillion company. You know,
right.
Make sure that, I mean, boo-hoo, come on, right? You know, let's have a fundraiser for them. And it's so ridiculous to me. And then, you know, and then of course, Taylor Swift, somebody has to get involved, but they won't get money on, and also the artist won't get money. They put the money in front of the art, and I guess we can't really be surprised by that.
Yeah, they put their profit margins first. And so I made a video about challenging, say, Spotify, Apple, all these other places to go to a penny per stream. And recently, Apple has responded, not to me directly, but they responded to that sentiment where they should go to a penny per stream. And they're working really hard to try to get there. And that's way better than 0.003 of a penny.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It's not
better.
It's not 100% there, right? Right. It could be better because they have enough money to pay artists. Realistically, I would like to see, like, realistically, I think a penny per stream is affordable. And I did some math within that video, and I think it's a small price to pay for artists in the grand scheme of things.
Absolutely. You know, they're nothing without the artist, you know. You know, they have a platform. Of course, there's expenses there to get that out and everything, but once it's made, the expenses don't really increase by that much. It's wordplay, TJ. I can't thank you enough. I would love
thank
to.
You.
I've so many. Thanks so much for your time today. When does Terry drop?
So I don't have a release date for it, but I hope to get it out by next summer. I hope that this new record, my 9th album, is gonna be something that challenges people. Like you said earlier, right? You said that, you know, Rock the Bells, right, had a moment in it where it's like, can he say that? And I think that's
right.
Where I am with my art is like, I want to kind of push it a little bit and say, have some moments where it's like, can he say that? Did he just say that? Like, I want a lot of that in my next record, Terry.
I remember, you know, we listened to everything all New York. You know, the artists go on and on, Salt and Pepper and Big Daddy Kane and, you know, De La Soul. And then when NWA came out and we heard that for the first time, I said, how can this possibly be good? And we were just mesmerized. We were just absolute California. I can't, it's very different, but it shook everything up, and it was a big, big difference, and it was loved. It was great. I love to talk to you then, maybe even sooner, when your next album comes out, and I'm going to continue listening, and I'm going to encourage others to do it. Yeah. I really appreciate your time. How can people get in touch with you, please? Wordplay, TJ.
Yeah. So everybody can get in touch with me everywhere online when they search for wordplayt.jay. It's on every platform, whether it be my website, wordplaytj.com. On YouTube, on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, you can't miss it. Just Google it, and you will find all of that stuff on Spotify, iTunes. I mean, I'm playing and active in more than 70 different countries right now, and so, I made it so you can't miss me. That was one of my things. It's like, I got to get the marketing right first so you can't miss me. So wordplayt.jay.
Excellent. And if you had your preference, how would you like your music listened to? Like, on what platform helps you the best?
I think Spotify is my favorite right now, even though they don't pay the best. But outside of listening on a streaming service, because, you know, like I said, I'm for the fan. So I think the listener should have their preference of where they listen, right? So any streaming service, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, whatever works best for your situation. But go a little bit above that, right? Go to Bandcamp and find me there, wordplayt.jay, and purchase one of the albums. Go to my website and purchase a little bit of the merchandise, or go to my YouTube channel and watch those videos. Any of that participation will help. And so, and lastly, right, always share something that you listen to of mine with somebody else.
And I saw you also have a Patreon.
Yeah, I have a Patreon. I'm new to it, so I'm like really shy about promoting it. But that's one of those things that I have to get over, right? One of my areas of opportunity for discipline is my Patreon. But yeah, you can go to Patreon and support me there. $5 will get you regular updates, exclusive things behind the scenes. And I got a new one coming out on at the end of the month, in a couple of days, on August 31st, where I share some behind the scenes stuff from my new music video, Jam.
Fantastic. Wordplay TJ, thank you so much for your time today. I wish you continued success. Please keep up the great work. I find you incredibly fascinating. I really enjoy your music. I find you well-disciplined and a role model. I thanks so much for your time today. I hope we get to talk again in the future.
Yeah, I know we will, Joey. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a really, really, really great interview.
Thanks so much. Be well. Bye now.
Take care.
Thank you for listening and or viewing Joey Pin's Discipline Conversations. Please share this episode with one or two of your friends who you think may benefit from the episode. Our website, www.joeypins.com. There you find lots of resources and you could join our mailing list. Please follow us on all our social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Podcast information, the video version of our podcast is on YouTube. Please subscribe. Audio is on all major podcasting platforms. Please follow them. And if you like it, please consider giving 5-star rating. Would really appreciate that. Would you like to financially support the podcast? You can go to our Patreon site. Consider $5, $10, or $20 a month. There's all kind of plans that we have there. It's like a one-time payment. What is this podcast episode worth to you? $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000. You be the judge. You can go to our PayPal account to do that as well. Thank you again for listening or watching Joey Pin's Discipline Conversation.